Headlines: Iran's top general says his country is determined to continue to develop its drone program, which is already among the world's top five. The Kremlin says Russia will never accept any price cap on its energy resources because it leads to destruction of the market pricing process. And the death toll from a severe Arctic freeze that has gripped the United States and Canada rises to at least 38, with millions under alerts. Our top story: Iran is standing among the world's top five drone powers, with its UAVs ranking high in terms of accuracy and endurance. Major General Mohammad Baqiri says claims by Western powers that Iranian-made drones are being deployed by other countries are part of the anti-Iran psychological warfare, yet they show that Iranian unmanned aerial vehicles are effective. The chief of the Joint Staff of Iranian Armed Forces says Iran has developed the drone capacity by using domestic resources and cooperation with domestic universities and research centers. The general stressed that Iranian Armed Forces will continue to develop their drone power and embark on relevant cooperation with other countries. Normalization deals between some Arab states and Israel continue to draw public anger. In Morocco, people have held protest rallies in more than two dozen cities to condemn ties with the Tel Aviv regime. The centerpiece of the protests was staged in the capital, Rabat, where demonstrators marched on the parliament. They chanted slogans and held signs calling the deal treacherous and demanding its cancellation. They also set fire to the Israeli flag and reiterated their unwavering support for the Palestinian cause. Israel and Morocco agreed to a US-sponsored deal to normalize relations in December 2020. Three other Arab countries had already signed similar agreements with the regime. The agreements have been widely denounced by Palestinian groups and Muslim nations. And earlier in our news review program, we discussed Israeli normalization deals with a number of Arab states and the public backlash against them.
To discuss that further, we're joined by Barry Grossman, international lawyer, joining us live from Bali, and also Wafa Al-Udaini, a Palestinian activist and journalist, joining us from Gaza City. Thank you very much to both of you for joining us on this edition of the News Review. Let's begin with Barry Grossman. Now, we hear these people chanting slogans which are completely the opposite of the road that their government is going down.
From the beginning, that the policy embraced by Morocco's government is completely at odds with popular opinion in Morocco and indeed across most of the Arab world. In fact, something approaching or slightly exceeding 80% of people are fully committed to supporting Palestinians and the Palestinian cause without qualification, and in denouncing any normalization, or what they like to call partial normalization, with the occupation. So the starting point in understanding any of this has to be recognizing that these moves towards normalization, and they're very significant moves, I might add, are entirely contrary to public opinion in the nations involved.
So, Wafa Al-Udaini, it was interesting for us to see during the games, the FIFA World Cup, we saw Moroccans holding a Palestinian flag and, of course, expressing their unwavering support for the Palestinian cause, and that actually attracted a lot of attention.
Indeed, what happened with in the World Cup, indeed, it was like a slap to in the face of the occupation, because their main aim behind signing this agreement is to cut the ties between the Arab nations, to cut the ties between the Arab countries, and then weaken the Arabs more and more. But what happened exactly in the World Cup, and when we see the Moroccan national team raising the Palestinian flag, this thing, like, it was like an earthquake for the occupation, because, and even the Moroccan people, not only the national team, even the Moroccan people, we saw them holding the Palestinian flag beside the Moroccan flag. And this thing proves that their normalization and their assignment is against the people's will. And indeed, we all know that the Moroccan people are among the most supportive people for the Palestinian cause. So, and the protests that we see these days, indeed, another proof to this thing. So no matter they do for the Arab nations and the Arab countries, actually they will not hinder them from supporting the just Palestinian cause.
So, Mr. Grossman, you just pointed to the rift between the people, the nation, and the government. And this doesn't seem to apply only to Morocco. We've seen this in other Arab countries that have normalized ties with Israel. We see that this is not a popular move, and the nation actually does not support the government's move of normalizing ties with Israel.
Absolutely. We're also seeing a lot of the same sort of sentiment in the wider Atlantic world. I guess what's important is that there seems to be a whole lot more understanding in Arab nations about what these 2020 Abraham Accords actually ceded to the occupation. So in essence, what's required under these accords is for the signatory country, in this case Morocco, to work with the United States and with the occupation to prevent any hostile action against the occupation whatsoever, and to essentially criminalize any support, external support, based in Morocco that might be construed as supporting hostile action, like, for example, armed conflict in occupied Palestine. And more importantly, it obliges Morocco and other signatory countries to fully embrace, fully submit to a U.S.-sponsored strategic agenda for the Middle East, which also involves regional security agreements and cooperating on intelligence and everything else. And finally, the accords stipulate that the signatory country may not enact any legislation which is in conflict with any part of the Abraham Accords, and that to the extent there is any conflict, be it with domestic legislation or other international treaties, that it's the Abraham Accords that prevail. So no small part of the independence of the signatory country has been signed away by signing on to these accords, which they like to characterize as a partial normalization, but it's in fact a complete rollover.
And Ms. O'Dani, in your opinion, do you believe that the public pressure and the popular movements can actually lead the governments to back down from the stances they have and having normalized their ties with Israel?
Yeah, of course. I do believe in the power of people, that they are the ones who put the pressure in their government, and that they can change. I know that this step is a little bit late to change, but I do believe in the power of people. When they decide to do something, when they revolute, nobody can hinder them and nobody can stop them or even silence them, because this normalization deal, actually, it was based on something wrong. So for sure, this thing, this wrong thing, is going to break one day, and the people will have their word one day, inshallah, and I hope very soon.
Thank you very much, Wafa Al-Odaini, a Palestinian activist and journalist joining us from Gaza. and Barry Grossman, international lawyer from Bali. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review.
Turning elsewhere now, Russia says it won't give in to any price caps on its energy resources, adding the issue is out of the question. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said imposing such caps is unacceptable and that Russia is opposed to any interference in the process of market pricing. The European Union, the G7 group of developed economies, as well as Australia, reached an agreement on enforcing a ceiling of $60 per barrel on Russian oil in early December. Moscow has already said it plans to set up a mechanism which bans Russian companies from selling oil to countries imposing a price cap on Russian oil. And only Russia's nuclear arms are preventing the West from waging a war against Moscow. That's according to a top ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Former President Dmitry Medvedev says if Russia did not get the security guarantees it is demanding, the world would be on the brink of another world war and nuclear catastrophe. He, however, said Moscow will do everything to prevent that from happening. Medvedev, who is now the deputy chairman of Russia's Security Council, also says Moscow would pursue its war in Ukraine until, quote, the fascist regime in Kiev is removed and the country is demilitarized. Russian officials have time and again reiterated that the country's nuclear arsenal is a purely defensive one. They say Russia's policy on nuclear weapons is to use them if there is a threat to its territorial integrity. And Minsk says Iskander and S-400 missile systems deployed by Russian forces to Belarus are fully prepared and ready to perform their intended tasks. The Belarusian Defense Ministry said the country's servicemen and crew have fully completed their training in the joint combat centers of the Russian Federation and the Republic of Belarus. Russian President Vladimir Putin said in June that Moscow would supply Minsk with the Iskander and S-400 missile systems. The Iskander tactical missile systems are capable of carrying nuclear weapons. The S-400s are surface-to-air missile interception systems capable of engaging aircraft, UAVs, cruise projectiles. They also have terminal ballistic missile defense capability. The year 2022 is drawing to a close, and this is typically a festive time marked by happiness. But for many families in the US and the United Kingdom, this year has been especially hard as they had to deal with issues ranging from hunger to a cost of living crisis.
This Christmas is not a time for cheers and festivities for many in the U.S. A hunger crisis is affecting U.S. households. Food insecurity is already a critical problem affecting millions of Americans. One of the most typical factors affecting people suffering from food insecurity this time of the year are extreme winter conditions. But this year especially, many are suffering from hunger and high food prices due to unprecedented inflation that has gripped the U.S.
The gas, the food, everything, milk, egg, everything is is high now.
It is concerning, so I always shop online to make sure that I can find the best for groceries and for, like, gas as well.
Last year, more than 33 million Americans lived in food-insecure households, including 9 million children. The figure dropped in 2021, thanks to COVID relief programs. One also does not need to look any further than U.S.'s food assistance program called SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, to see the severity of the problem. The federal government increased SNAP by 12.5% this fall, adjusted to the rate of inflation. In the fiscal year 2021, SNAP served an average of 41.5 million people per month. The U.S. President Joe Biden may boast of a minor drop in inflation.
And yesterday, we got data that showed that manufacturing orders were up, but cost increases in supply chain items were beginning to ease. The week before that, we got data showing that price increase may be beginning to ease as well.
But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. population is suffering from poverty, unemployment, a lack of affordable housing, and lack of access to health care. This is on top of systemic racial inequities. All of these factors have driven food insecurity that affects around 10% of U.S. households.
So the U.S. is not the only country suffering from food poverty. The U.K. is also experiencing the same issue, mainly due to inflation, which are at record levels in both countries. The rest of the world is also suffering from food inflation. The war in Ukraine has exacerbated the situation when it comes to wheat production. For example, Ukraine's output has fallen by 40%, affecting millions of people worldwide. Moving on, the death toll from a brutal blizzard in the U.S. and Canada has risen to at least 38 as the Arctic freeze continues to ravish North America. Officials say 34 people died across the U.S. where the extreme weather conditions have struck the city of Buffalo in the state of New York the hardest. There, people were found dead in cars or snow banks. Around 200,000 Americans remain without electricity nationwide after the number peaked at 1.8 million on Saturday. Meanwhile, more than 50 million Americans remain under some sort of weather alert. The icy conditions have also taken their toll on neighboring Canada, where four people have died in a bus rollover accident. Blackouts are also reported in several areas, including in Quebec, where almost 120,000 households are without electricity.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
the Shahed 136 kamikaze drone, symbol of Iran's advancement in aerospace technology. Techniques of modern warfare have changed considerably in the last few decades, and unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, also known as drones, now play a very important part in modern warfare, with all the top military powers of the world now making extensive use of these unmanned aircraft. In recent years, the Islamic Republic of Iran has made astonishing advances in drone technology and manufacture of unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs. In this program, we will take a look at the Shahed 136 drone, an Iranian-made drone which has come to symbolize Iran's remarkable advancement in aerospace technology. Please stay with us. The Islamic Republic of Iran has invested heavily in drone technology during the past three decades and has made eye-catching progress in this field. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC Aerospace Division, initially focused on manufacture of tactical and reconnaissance drones, later switching to manufacture of kamikaze drones, also known as loitering munition. The wide variety of drones manufactured by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, have certainly proven their worth, their versatility, and their capabilities on various battlefields in regional conflicts in West Asia, including their reconnaissance capabilities, their target-finding abilities, and their offensive capabilities. The Islamic Republic of Iran has a special place among drone manufacturing countries, both in terms of quantity and quality of the drones that it manufactures. Without a doubt, Iran produces the most sophisticated and technologically superior drones or unmanned aerial vehicles in the West Asia region. Drones or unmanned aerial vehicles can be divided into three categories, namely reconnaissance, combat, and kamikaze or suicide drones. Among these, kamikaze drones are the rarest, and only a few types of these drones have ever been produced by countries which possess this technology. Certainly, the effectiveness of kamikaze drones have been demonstrated amply during the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict in 2020 and the Ukraine war in 2022. The Islamic Republic of Iran will continue to develop even more capable and more sophisticated drones which are useful for a variety of purposes. The Hesar Shahed 136 drone is an Iranian loitering munition in the form of an autonomous pusher-prop drone. It is designed and manufactured by Shahed Aviation Industries, which is part of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Division, IRGC Aerospace Division. The development of the Shahed 136 drone was a top-secret project, and very little information about this radar-evading and stealth drone was publicly available until very recently. Its capabilities and specifications were a closely guarded secret. In fact, the first time the drone was put on public display was during the Great Prophet 15 military exercises, which Iran's military forces carried out in 2021. The drone is made by the Iran Aircraft Manufacturing Industries, more famously known by its Persian acronym, HESA. The munition is designed to attack ground targets from a distance, fired in multiples from a launch rack in batches of five upwards. It can also be launched from back of lorries and back of trucks to overwhelm air defenses by consuming their resources during the attack. The Shahed 136 drone has a cropped delta wing shape with a central fuselage blending into the wings and stabilizing rudders at the tips of the wings. The nose section contains a warhead, which weighs about 40 kilograms. The engine sits in the rear of the fuselage and drives a two-bladed propeller in a pusher arrangement. The munition is 3.5 meters long, with a wingspan of 2.5 meters, and it flies at a speed of over 185 kilometers per hour and weighs about 200 kilograms. The range of this aircraft is well over 2,000 kilometers and is usable in a pre-programmed direct attack munition mode, somewhat like a long-range cruise missile. Also, it can be operated as a long-duration loitering munition mode, limited by a radio signal range of about 200 kilometers. The Shahed 136 comes in three different varieties: anti-personnel, anti-armored vehicle, and anti-fortification and radar seeker. Because of the portability and launch frame of the drone assembly, the entire unit can be mounted on the back of military or commercial trucks. The aircraft is launched at a slightly upward angle and is assisted in initial flight by rocket launch assistance. The rocket is jettisoned immediately after launch, whereupon the drone's conventional Iranian-made MD-550 four-cylinder piston engine takes over. The Shahed 136 drone is visually similar to the smaller Shahed 131 drone, differing mainly by its wingtip stabilizers standing up and down rather than only up on the Shahed 131. The Shahed 136 drone is most effective when it's used in batches for offensive purposes. This was demonstrated quite visibly and quite clearly during the Great Prophet 17 military exercises in the Islamic Republic of Iran. In those exercises, the drone was launched from back of trucks, commercial trucks, in batches of five, and it was extremely effective against its targets. The launch of drones from back of trucks is known as hit-and-run launch. The technique of using Shahed 136 drones in batches is extremely effective militarily, and it can cripple the enemy.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin has instructed his defense chiefs to do more for Russian troops in Ukraine. He says the country's military-industrial complex should provide the army with everything that they need. Why would this request come at this time? Is the war going to get an upgrade in the form of weapons from Russia to defeat Ukraine, or is it in reaction to the massive and continuous military aid that the U.S. and its allies are providing Zelensky? To get answers on that and a whole lot more, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Ray McGovern joins us. He's a former CIA analyst joining us from Raleigh. Also joining us is Daniel Kovalik, professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, who joins us from Pittsburgh, PA.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Ray McGovern, let me first start with you. I'm curious if you can break down this announcement by the Russian president, because it's hard to decipher what he is exactly announcing. I mean, the news reads he told the country's defense industry chiefs to increase efforts to ensure that the Russian army quickly receives all the weapons, equipment, and military hardware. There's some key words there, like receiving the hardware quickly, and then to increase the efforts. Can you break this down as to what he's exactly saying here?
Yes, I believe I can. Most people, myself included, expect a major Russian military offensive to start within a couple of weeks. The Russians have what the fancy strategists call escalatory dominance, not only regionally, take a look at the map, but also, the Russians are not running out of spare parts. They're not running out of weapons. They're not running out of missiles or rockets. NATO and the U.S. are. So the question is, when this offensive starts, and Putin is drawing a line to emphasize that it will start and it will be backed up by increasing industrial production in Russia, when it starts, and when the Ukrainian army is finished off, what does NATO, what does the U.S. really do? A lot of people think that the U.S. just can't afford to lose. Well, they're going to have to lose unless they resort to the unmentionable. I mean, nuclear weapons or something that is so provocative that it will start a major war, at least in Europe, perhaps worldwide. God forbid.
What led you to think, along with other analysts, as you just said, that Putin is getting ready for an offensive, aside from this piece of news?
Well, the mobilization of 300,000 troops, hello. I have to confess that back in the day, a year ago, I didn't really think that those troops would go into Ukraine. I thought this was a masterstroke of diplomatic use of force. They went in. It shows how serious Putin is. He has full support in Russia. I think it's down now to about 79%. It has been at 80. And if he faces internal pressure, it's to escalate. It's in the vein of, why didn't you do this several months ago? Why didn't you do it in 2014 when we really and truly had nothing to contend with on the other side, Ukrainian troops being a laughingstock? What happened? The Ukrainian troops got built up and got armed and equipped and trained by NATO, and now they're a major fighting force. That is what's left of them, and what's left of them is less than 200,000 troops.
All right. The term used there, Daniel Kovalik, by Ray McGovern, was escalatory dominance. So this seems to be the case when we take a look at what Putin has said. Quote, the most important key task of our military-industrial complex is to provide our units and frontline forces with everything that they need. And he goes on to say weapons, equipment, ammunition, and gear in the necessary quantities and of the right quality in the shortest possible time frames. So that seems like there's a sense of urgency there behind his request, isn't it?
Yeah, I think for a few reasons. I think for the reasons Ray said, I think there are some indications that the Russians are planning to escalate in Ukraine. One of the indications are the meetings of Putin and then Medvedev had in Belarus. And I've seen videos of tanks being moved in Belarus. It may be they're planning an invasion from Belarus, which may be aimed at Kiev. So there are some indications, certainly, of such an escalation. I think, though, too, what he is saying may be a response to concerns in Russia that this has taken too long, that too many Russians have died and are dying. As I understand it, more Russians are dying per month in Ukraine than Americans were losing in Vietnam, you know, which is significant. Now, obviously, the Ukrainians are losing a lot more people, something like 8 to 10 times more, but still the Russians are losing a lot and people are frustrated with that. So I think there's a couple reasons he's saying, look, we got to make sure we're prepared and get this thing done.
Ray McGovern, to add to this, he has said that he would ensure that the Army's funds were met. There are no funding restrictions, according to what I'm reading here. And of course, some say, well, this is militarizing the economy. But as you said, this sounds like Russia is getting prepared for this military escalation. But hadn't Putin just days ago or maybe a week ago at this point had said that he is ready for a negotiated solution, that he wants Zelensky, if there is a will, to come to the negotiating table, that that's where things should end? And this, again, was just recent statements by him.
Well, first of all, Putin himself says and has said more than once that he does not want to militarize the economy. He wants to do this in a gradual stage. His initial purpose to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine, he thought he could do that with maybe 100, 200,000 troops. He has been forced to realize that ain't going to work. He's got to put more in. And only then did he actually mobilize 300,000 more. So we're in this for the duration. The question is how the U.S. is going to react to this. And my main concern is the U.S. doesn't realize, now get this, the U.S. doesn't realize that it's two against one. What am I saying? I'm saying it's Russia and China against the U.S. Why do I say that? Well, as recently as 30 minutes ago, the Foreign Ministry of China pronounced that the U.S. military budget, the National Defense Authorization Act, is a serious provocation of China. Okay? These two people are joined at the hip now, and U.S. policymakers don't seem to realize that. Witness the fact that as soon as they learned that Zelensky was going to Washington, who do they send to Beijing? The former Russian President Medvedev, and what was that? That was a cordial mission with Xi participating and they pledging their enduring alliance. So it's two against one, and that's why I believe Putin feels so self-confident in saying, well, we're going to do this. Now, I would rush to add that I don't think he's going to try to do this in one fell swoop. It's going to take months, okay? But during those months, people in Europe are going to start freezing to death. And the Germans are already going a little wobbly. Witness the fact that Steinmeier shows up in Beijing last week as well. So there are things that Putin is calculating that would restrain him from going full bore, but he's certainly got enough troops to finish off the Ukrainian armies. And the question is, will NATO come in? I hope not. Some serious people think they will.
Okay, so just to make sure that I understand you correctly, amongst the statements that you made there, given the fact that you said that they're joined at the hip in a sense, and given this fact that you said that you heard that you had this piece of news about Russia and the U.S. military budget, where China thinks is a serious provocation, does that mean that when you say Russia and China are together in this, that militarily they're going to be involved, or are we looking at that not happening, as you said, immediately, but rather in stages or in the maybe far future, not in the near future?
Not going to happen in the near future. This week, the Russians and Chinese are naval exercising in the East China Sea. Their military cooperation is like this. And if the U.S. has any sense, it's not going to start a major war in Central Europe and risk the notion that China will come in and stir up real trouble in the South China, East China Seas, or again in the Taiwan Straits. This is a real possibility. The people in Washington don't seem to realize that. That raises the risk decidedly.
Daniel Kovalik, the scenario that Ray McGovern paints for us, what do you think of it? Do you agree with that? Do you see it that way, for it to pan out that way, maybe?
You mean that China and Russia are joined together to resist this? Yeah, I do think that.
Yeah, exactly.
I think they have to be joined, because I think the U.S. has their sights on both those countries. I mean, and they're making that very clear. You know, and it's interesting, the Democrats seem interested in going after Russia. The Republicans seem interested in going after China. But either way you look at it, they're both in the sights of the U.S. And so both of them have been forced together, you know. And it's interesting from a geopolitical point of view, the U.S. has completely botched the situation. You know, when the U.S. was smarter, you know, it was good at dividing Russia from China, as Nixon and Kissinger did in the early 1970s. But now everything the U.S. has done is forced them together economically, militarily, and they're going to be joined together for quite some time because, again, I think they both feel under existential threat by the United States. And in fact, I think they are. So, and hopefully them being so close at this point, I hope that's a deterrence from the U.S. doing something crazy. But I feel like we are being led by crazy people.
Crazy people.
For crazy ends. I think John Lennon said that once. And, you know, but I hope that more rational minds will prevail.
Just 3 days ago.
But let me just interject.
Go ahead, Ray McGovern.
Let me just interject here on this matter of craziness. Putin himself at Valdai on October 28th permitted himself to say, you know, I used to suspect there was some subtle reasoning in how the U.S. is taking on China at the same time it's taking on Russia. But there's no subtle reasoning there. I'm convinced now they're just crazy. Well, you know, two against one is crazy. And the big factor here, of course, is how Putin has to look at this, okay? Has to be confident on the one hand and has to really avoid provoking the U.S. so that he'll have to ask China to come in and distract the U.S. with a two-front war.
All right. Ray McGovern, let me ask you this. Putin just days ago said that NATO is using all of its potential against Russia. Now, I'm assuming that when he says that, the U.S. is also involved somewhat in this. So the first question is if that's the case, well, isn't Ukraine losing the battle on the ground if it has not been able to defeat Russia in a sense?
That's really a good question. The mainstream media in this country and elsewhere in the West says that the Ukrainians are winning, that they're making advances. Nothing could be farther from the truth. The Russians are building up now. They're ready to go. And so it's not a question of whether Ukraine can win this thing. All the military experts that I value, and, you know, I spent 2 years as an Army military analyst myself, I suggest that, again, as Obama warned, President Obama in 2016, the Russians have escalatory power here. And he said, you know, the U.S. does not have vital interests here. It's the Russians that have this escalatory dominance, is the word I was thinking of. And that's what the U.S. is used to, dominance. And that's what these fellows, Jacob Sullivan and Blinken, think the U.S. still has. And that's why Putin calls them a little bit crazy, not subtle at all. And that's what Putin has to deal with.
Okay, so I was going to ask the question, who are the crazies in the U.S.? You just mentioned a couple of them, I think. So what are we looking at here, Daniel Kovalik, in terms of the craziness? Are we looking at one particular character like a Sullivan, like a Blinken, like a Biden? Are we looking at the ones playing behind the scenes, maybe the Pentagon, maybe the military manufacturers? Because it doesn't sound like there's a concrete plan, as Ray McGovern said, and I think that you agreed, that the U.S. is dealing with two against one, and it doesn't really have a successful plan in play here.
No, it does, and I think the ruling class is divided about all of this. You mentioned the Pentagon. As far as I can tell, the Pentagon is the more rational actor here. They tend to say to be much more cautious. It is the State Department, ironically, which is supposed to be the diplomatic wing of the United States, that is the more belligerent. And it is Blinken that seems to be pushing for this, and Sullivan. I think Biden, honestly, is, I'm not sure he's in charge of much. I'm not sure where his mental faculties are. But certainly the State Department is pushing hard for a conflict with Russia and or China. I think that is where the craziness is coming from. But again, I don't think it's limited to them either. I mean, I think you have deep dysfunction in Washington, in both parties. And, you know, this has been obviously demonstrated by the most recent defense spending bill, which is a record level bill, you know, which gave more money to Biden than he even asked for. And that's been true in the last several budgets, right? You have a country that only knows war now. And again, where its own diplomatic wing, the State Department, doesn't do diplomacy anymore. And that's a pretty scary thing. And then meanwhile, you don't have much of a peace movement on the ground trying to ask for anything different. So you're left with a very very dangerous situation.
Okay, let's see here. Ray McGovern, you have Zelensky, who has been provided military aid, of which I can cite some figures. But overall, you're looking at the U.S. being the top donor, if you want to call it that, even though Zelensky said you're not making donations, you're rooting for democracy and safety. Anyways, so he's right. Been provided that, along with European countries or NATO member countries, to provide him with military aid also. And then he makes this trip to Washington, okay, which prior to that there were rumors about the Patriot missile system being given to Ukraine. That has happened. But based on the New York Times headline, he didn't get all of that he wanted. And what I'm reading here is that he didn't get, I'm not sure what these are, ATACM long-range missiles, Abrams tanks, we know what that is, German Leopard and Martyr tanks, of which I want to ask you, if he's not getting what he wants, does that mean the U.S. is afraid of giving him those weapons because it's going to go into Russian soil? Because logic dictates if he wants those, then maybe he could defeat Russia. What's the scenario here?
Okay, good question. No way is Ukraine going to defeat Russia, okay? Now, ATACMS, those are the fancy missiles that go 200 miles, okay? They can go into Russia. There have been strikes within Russia proper. If I were Putin, I would say, they're really trying to provoke me now, but we have escalatory dominance. We're going to go grind away And by the time the spring comes, we'll have a new set of circumstances on the ground. Now, with respect to Washington, yeah, there are two minds. Oh, we want to get in a war with Russia, but we want to give them everything it needs. Well, the two cannot be reconciled unless you want to talk about nuclear weapons. So there's a dilemma here. I don't know which side is going to win. I wish that Biden were more compass mentis, because it makes sense simply to back off here, given the fact that Obama himself said there's no core interest for the United States in Ukraine, and there is indeed for Russia, but that's not guaranteed. I don't know how it's going to work out.
All right. The notion of peace, not at the core, to say the least, Daniel Kovalik, as you mentioned, of this defense spending bill. Why are we even calling it a defense spending bill? Maybe that's another topic for another program. But why has the U.S. not been in line with that? And looking at how it's looks like U.S. is conflict hungry. It's after provocations. It's after being entangled in these war scenarios. I mean, there was some point years ago where the U.S. was either directly or covertly involved in more than 85 military operations. Why does the U.S. feel like it has to do that? Is it because it's got military bases all over the world, said to be over 600 or 650 plus? Why is this why isn't peace at the center of U.S. Moves, which should be diplomacy?
Well, I think there's a few reasons. I think some of it is that the U.S. is an empire, and those at the top understand that, and they want to maintain it. It's as simple as that. And they want to do it think the only way to do it is through war. That's one reason. I think the other reason is the military-industrial complex that, of course, Eisenhower warned about in the 1950s. And what he saw was nothing compared to what we have today. When he said it, you had a military-industrial complex, but it was smaller. And moreover, you had more of a domestic, you know, production of commercial consumer goods in the U.S., right? So now the only thing we make are weapons practically, right? Almost all of our industry has been offshore. So the only industry left for the most part is defense or war, however you want to define it. And so they have an incredible amount of say over what happens in Washington. And then that's what a lot of this is about, is keeping those defense contractors fed. And again, that military-industrial nightmare that Eisenhower predicted, we are living through now.
Okay, very well. We're going to end it there. Thank you so much for that. Let me thank our guest, Ray McGovern, who's a former CIA analyst from Raleigh. Thank you so much. Danny Kovalik, professor of international human rights, University of Pittsburgh, School of Law from Pittsburgh, PA. I'd like to thank you both and wish you happy holidays also at the same time. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Today's question asks, why Lady Fatima al-Zahra was buried secretly? And still, till today, nobody knows the exact place or grave of this respected lady. She was a famous girl of Prophet Muhammad. She was the famous daughter of Prophet Muhammad. She was known to the Muslim community. She was the mother of two of the A'immas of the Shias, but still nobody knows the exact place of her burial place. Why?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is a very significant question that we need to ponder upon, as not only as Shias. I believe that all Muslims should ask this question, that why, when it comes to Lady Zahra Salamullahi Alayha, the holy daughter of our Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, why the place of her burial is not known by anyone. Although some of the Salafis in cemetery of Baqi, when some Muslims ask them, they just refer to the point that just a claim that she is buried in Baqi cemetery. Mm-hmm. But I believe that they themselves do know that this is just a big lie and no one knows about the exact burial place of Lady Zahra Salamullahi Alayha. So it's a very important question, and there is no doubt about this fact, and that Lady Zahra Salamullahi Alayha was buried secretly, and there are a bunch of evidence in both Shia and Sunni sources about that. Of course, let me refer to another point, that it's not only Lady Zahra Salamullahi Alayha. We know that Imam Ali Alayhi Salam was also buried secretly, but for him it was not intended by him to be secret forever or till the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Later, his burial place in Najaf became known by one of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
That's right.
So, when we put together all the narrations in both Shia and Sunni sources, it becomes clear that first of all, it was based on the will on or wasiya of Lady Zahra Salamullahi Alayha. She asked Imam Ali Alayhi Salam, she made this will that she should be buried secretly, and especially without the presence of some of the so-called companions of the Prophet, yes, peace be upon him, and his family. So first of all, why she was buried secretly? Because it was her own will.
Yes.
And all in all, it seemed that it was a very explicit policy of Lady Zahra Salamullahi Alayha to show her dissatisfaction with some of the companions of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, especially the first two caliphs. And there are, many evidences for this, not only in Shia, but also in Sunni sources.
Yes.
Again, let me refer to the fact that as Shia, we do believe in unity between Shia and Sunni. We do, yes, believe in the fact that no one has the right to disrespect the companions of the Prophet, especially those who are respected by our Sunni brothers and sisters. This is a fact. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't study the history. As I mentioned, as Muslims, whether Shia or Sunni,